Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson and I'm delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and overlapping conditions. This season particularly is important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign, designed to ensure that the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. So to commence today, I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally rather than now. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care, a world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and, dare I dream, a world where we have a cure for these diseases. Today, I'm really delighted to introduce Tracy Collins to our podcast. Tracy has been unwell with ME/CFS and associated conditions for over 19 years. Tracy rarely leaves her bed, let alone her house, but with the little physical and mental energy she has, she is committed to advocate for the government to do more to help people like her living with these invisible illnesses. And it is to Tracy and all those with severe ME that we dedicate this podcast series. So, Tracy, welcome to this Emerge Australia podcast.
Thanks, Anne.
So, to kick things off, as we usually do, and I hope it won't be too painful for you, can you share with us your journey with ME over the past 19 years and the impact it's had on your daily life and well-being?
Sure. So before getting to severe ME, I had a very active life. I loved playing sports, was often outdoors. I loved spending time with my family, and I had a career that I loved. I was an accountant. I then moved into education. I ran projects, and then I led lots of big teams. And across all of my career, I really thrived when I was solving complex problems, asking questions, understanding complexity and helping people learn and implement change. But thinking back, I was always actually unwell throughout that whole time. It wasn't like severe ME, but it was a bit more like, say, asthma and allergies that I had as a child. So I'd have these flare-ups of my symptoms and then I'd kind of just get back to normal. So that meant that it took me a long time to take my symptoms seriously. But in 2006, I got a pretty nasty bacterial infection and I never recovered. Over the next 16 years, I kept going to my doctors and I kept saying, I don't feel well. Something's wrong. They would do the tests. They would tell me there was nothing in the tests. And so I would walk away thinking, okay, there's nothing wrong. Just ignore the symptoms. Keep going. Finally, in 2022, I went to the doctors. I went to a new doctor and I said, there's definitely something wrong. What is it? And I actually said the magic words. When I stand up, I get dizzy. And that sounds like something really simple, but that was the key that opened the door to a diagnosis for me. That GP recognized that me standing up and being dizzy might be POTS. So she referred me to a cardiologist. And the cardiologist said, actually, you don't meet the criteria for POTS, but I think you have chronic fatigue syndrome. He then told me to go away and start exercising, doing 5 minutes a day, either on the treadmill or running around my backyard, and then increasing that by a minute every couple of days. And so I did, because I'm a rule follower. So I did what he said, and I kept increasing by a minute every couple of days until I eventually collapsed. I then had to finish work. He told me to take 3 months off work, so I did. And after a month, I realized I wasn't going back. I was actually getting sicker and sicker. Until the point in early 2023, where I was completely bedbound. I was living in a dark room with no noise, no screens, no reading, and very little interaction with other people. I rationed myself to 5 minutes an hour of some kind of exertion. That might mean talking to somebody. It might mean reading something. It might mean listening to something. But that was all I could manage. During those five-minute windows, I started to learn from the ME community. I started to learn how to listen rather than ignore what my body was telling me. I then started to understand what was going on and how to better respond. But also in that time, lying in the dark, I started thinking about how could I apply the skills that I had in my work life to this new problem? How could I still live my values, have a purpose, and have a meaningful life? So what I did was I came up with a new purpose, and that new purpose started with better understanding my illness and better responding so that I could use my time to do things that were meaningful to me. 3 years later, my baseline is still 19 to 20 hours a day in bed, in a dark room, and less than 15 minutes a day with my feet on the floor. I still have to really carefully manage my symptoms and manage my exertion using a framework that I developed to ensure that I minimize the physical, cognitive, emotional, orthostatic, and sensory exertions in every single thing that I do. So I can't be spontaneous anymore and I miss out on lots of things. But meaning for me now is different. I paint cards for my family to commemorate important events. I prioritize being with my family to celebrate milestones. I prioritize learning and I prioritize sharing. I haven't lost my curiosity, my ability to ask questions, to understand problems, to learn and to adapt. All of that is much slower now and is applied to a different context. But all of this means that there is still meaning in this very small life.
Well, what can I say about that, Tracy? The one thing when you started talking about what you could do at the time when things started changing was listen to your body. You know, it's quite interesting in all the podcasts that I've done with people with ME, I don't think I've heard anybody talking about listening to their body. And that is just so critical, of course, as you know, because listening to your body means that you are in tune with when to push and when to rest. And obviously that still remains a huge challenge for people, especially when people start feeling a bit better.
Totally. I think the problem is that because I wasn't believed or acknowledged as there being a problem for so long, what I did was I learnt to ignore every sign my body was telling me. Everything that wasn't normal, I had to think was normal. And so only once I stopped and I really started to understand those things were real, that they weren't normal, and they were the signs that my body was struggling, was I then able to stop making myself worse.
Yeah, I like that. I really like that. I think that in that statement you just made, there's a lot of learning that other people can take. You know, the fact that you started to feel that what was going on in your body was normal and then you learnt to ignore it. You know, a lot of us ignore things that are wrong, you know, like a sore back. Yeah, well, that's just a sore back, or I'm ignoring it, because push through is the thing that we're constantly doing, when of course the reality for people with ME, let alone severe ME, is that that is the antithesis of what you have to do. You can't push through. You've got to listen to what your battery is actually telling you.
Yep, that's exactly right. But it's also the hardest thing to learn.
Oh, you know, you're talking to someone who's constantly pushing through. I don't have ME, but, you know, I go, no, I'll be fine, I'll be fine. And I keep going. So luckily, I very rarely crash myself, but it's not the kind of crash that someone with ME has, where you have to go to bed, and some people are in bed for days and weeks and months and years at a time. It's really hard for anyone who doesn't know about the impact of severe ME to even fathom what that would feel like. So, Tracy, you've spoken about a lot of challenges already, but what do you see as being the biggest challenges that you face currently, particularly when it comes to accessing support and accessing healthcare?
Yeah, thanks, Anne. So I think there's multiple layers to this in my experience. So firstly, there's the illness itself, which we've just talked about, where we have so little capacity. Everything has a cost and requires trade-offs. But the second layer is that we almost have to become project managers of our illness. We have to coordinate such complex care. We have to find doctors who understand the illness. We have to organise referrals. We have to track investigations. We have to understand multiple diagnoses. We have to coordinate and fund the treatments. We have to manage the appointments. We have to navigate NDIS. We have to navigate disability support pension. We have to organise transport. We have to constantly prioritise where to spend our energy. And then on top of that, there's a layer of geography, which magnifies the burden for us. If we're bedbound, or if we live outside metropolitan areas, that adds a whole other layer of planning, of cost, of travel, of time and recovery. And then the fourth layer is that every system assumes that we have the capability to engage with all of these systems and processes and steps. Healthcare requires us to organise and attend appointments. NDIS requires us to be able to complete complex and challenging applications. DSP requires us to gather evidence. Even research assumes that we can participate. And support assumes that we can advocate for ourselves. But ME removes exactly the capacity that these systems assume that we have. So none of those on their own are the biggest challenge, but the biggest challenge is all of it, having to manage all of those things with an energy-limiting condition.
Look, I can't imagine. What about also having to manage your life within the family? How do you do that? I mean, you know, how does it feel to not be able to do the things that you want to do for your family?
I mean, that's a huge question, Anne, and I think it comes down to we have to prioritize. And everything, like I said, is a trade-off. So I do prioritize doing some things with my family, and we make birthdays particularly, especially important. One, because they're, I suppose, a reminder that there are important things that we need to share together, but also they create memories that then sustain us throughout those times that we're stuck in our rooms. Beautiful. In the dark.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it feels like, Tracy, to be in the dark for an extended period of time. What does it do to you?
No, I don't think anyone can. And when we talk a little bit later about understanding, I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is how does somebody understand a disease like this?
Yeah, how do you deal with it emotionally, Tracy?
I often say, and I want to preface this by saying that I know I'm very lucky, but I often say that I don't know how my mental health has remained as good as it is. But maybe it does come back to that time in the dark originally, thinking about what was my purpose and what is meaning for me and how can that look different with this illness rather than losing meaning and purpose altogether.
I'm going off script here. The word that comes to mind when I hear you speak is resilience. What is it in your life that has built the resilience that you've got right now?
I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. I think, like I said before, a lot of it is about me thinking about what's important to me. And what's always been important to me is my family, is learning, and is nature. That was always my values when we would do activities in my work. You know, they were the things that were important to me. And so at my worst, I actually thought while I was lying in my room, I used to love taking photos of flowers in my garden every week. And because we were on Zoom, or Teams in my case, I would put a photo from my garden on my background every day at work, and it would start conversations in the office, although we weren't together. And so then I thought about, well, how can I do that now? And so what I did was my husband would go out in the garden and pick flowers, and then we bought a flower press, and so I would press those flowers. And then I decided that I would then turn those into cards for my family and friends. And so I would make cards. And so each of those things would happen in 5-minute increments, but I was still connecting with nature. I was still connecting with my family. And I was still doing something that I suppose gave me some sense of purpose and enjoyment. So I suppose I just looked at how can I best use those 5 minutes, when it was only 5 minutes, to do something that was important to me. And now as my capacity has increased over the last few years, I still think like that. How do I use every minute that I have to be meaningful rather than to be just gone? I think it's sometimes easy, and I'm not saying that I'm perfect at this, but sometimes it's easy to do things that are not meaningful because maybe they take little energy. But I suppose prioritized in my mind making sure that the things I choose to do with that energy are important to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, coming through in what you're saying, you're an organized person. You think about what you're going to do, and you can organize yourself and prioritize. And we don't talk about that very much when we're talking about the impact of ME, but clearly for you, it appears that that's something quite innate, that you prioritize, you think about it, what's the most meaningful thing that I can do with the minutes that I've got. And I know that we often say to people when they're trying to learn how to pace, plan ahead. You know, if you've got something major coming up, you need to plan those rest periods well ahead of time so that you give yourself the best possible chance to be able to do whatever it is that's important. And it sounds to me as though it's that same type of principle of prioritizing. And I love the fact that you think about what to do with those precious minutes. I think that's beautiful. And so much of what I hear of from the ME community is that there are a lot of people who are quite arty. So they put the limited energy they've got into making something beautiful.
It's funny that you say that, because prior to this illness and prior to becoming severely unwell, amongst my family and friends, I was the least arty, least creative person that you would ever meet. And now the thing that I do is I draw and I paint. And I would never have imagined that that would be something that I could do. But it turns out that I can.
It's what,
and I find that to be something that I really appreciate being able to do. And now I paint cards for my family instead of pressing flowers.
I love it. I love it. So can I ask you, taking all of that into account, what types of support or services do you see that are most urgently needed, especially for people with severe ME?
Yeah, so following on from what we've just been talking about and moving into this question, I think at this point it's really important for me to acknowledge that I have significant privilege. I have a family that believes me and that has supported me. I have financial and housing stability. I have transferable skills from my work life. I have NDIS access. I can afford to pay for private appointments to avoid waiting lists, and I can afford to pay for treatments that aren't on the PBS. Without just one of those privileges, my situation would be very different and I wouldn't be talking to you today. So over the last 3 years, I've seen many small but meaningful improvements in my health and my capacity, and they've come through treating comorbidities and different symptoms. They've also come through having access to particularly allied health professionals who specialize in ME/CFS and our associated conditions. And I've also been able to access support workers and assistive technology via the NDIS. Each one of those things has provided opportunities to improve my quality of life. So when you ask what support or services are most urgently needed, I think what's needed is that every person who has ME/CFS has access to all of those things. Quality of life shouldn't depend on privilege or luck. So I think we need to be asking, how do we create equitable access for all patients? We already know enough to improve lives. I'm one example of that. What we need to do is make this available to everybody who needs it.
Yeah. I guess that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Certainly for organisations like Emerge Australia, we ask ourselves all the time, what is it that we can do better for people with ME? And so one of the areas that we focus on is, you know, creating that public awareness, not just in the eyes of those people who don't have it, but particularly with governments, and looking at health policy change, helping governments understand ME, especially severe ME, and also working to reduce stigma and increase the support that is necessary. What else do you think organisations like Emerge Australia could do?
Well, I think that all of that is obviously connected. So we need much better understanding. And so maybe we could just slightly go off script, Dan. There's increased public awareness now around at least long COVID. When I say to people that I have ME, they usually don't know what that is. But if I say chronic fatigue syndrome, they usually have an idea of what that is. Often it's incorrect, but they often are aware of it. I think the gap is in the understanding piece, because unless people can understand, they can't really know how to respond. And ME/CFS is such a hard disease to understand. It's not like a broken leg or cancer or a flu even. that everyone understands, it's largely invisible. And I think one of the biggest barriers that we have is our dominant cultural disease model that says if you get an illness, you fight it, and then you recover. With ME/CFS, fighting looks very different. Fighting means saying no to things that you want to do. Fighting it means using a wheelchair, even though your legs still work. You need to use a wheelchair. Fighting it means reducing or stopping work. It means resting and staying in bed. But to people who don't understand, that looks like being lazy or giving up. It doesn't look like fighting. And so it's super hard for us to do all of those things, to say no, to stay in bed, to use a wheelchair. None of us want to do that. But it's also hard for others to truly understand what it's like to live with it. And largely that's why I started writing my blog, to explain ME through different lenses, using metaphors and stories. Because I think awareness is important, but understanding is the key to changing how people and systems respond. And then those responses create the opportunities for improvement in our quality of life. So I think there's roles for government and policymakers. I think there's roles for healthcare. I think there's roles for the community and allies. I suppose we could go into each of those things. So I'm not sure where you would like to start with that. But I do have thoughts about, you know, what each could be doing to help that once there is a better understanding.
Okay, we've got a limited amount of time right now, but I am very interested to understand where you see the specific gaps in the healthcare system, the services that are available, and or research, and, you know, what could be done in your view to improve the quality of life for those with ME.
Thanks, Anne. So we know that ME is complex and that it requires specialist knowledge and lots of time to treat it well. We also know that ME doesn't exist in isolation. So especially with severe ME, we've got multiple comorbidities. But we also know that ME doesn't fit into our current systems where diseases are put in silos. Across my diagnostic journey, I'm still on that path. Each time that I've found things that might be going wrong for me, whether that's through the community sharing or more recently through the Bateman-Horne clinical care guide, that's been a huge benefit to me to identify some of those comorbidities and pathways to explore. But each time I find one of those things, what I have to do is then research to understand that comorbidity. I then have to frame a request to my GP to ask for a referral to a specialist that I have gone and found who is interested and knowledgeable about ME and that comorbidity. The GP does the referral. I then have to organise the appointment and wait, afford to pay for that appointment, go to that appointment, which at the moment has caused 6 months of ongoing rolling PEM. But then sometimes I get treatments out of those referrals, and those things make incremental improvements. But what I wonder is, how can we actually organise the care around the patient rather than the diagnoses? There's lots of examples that already exist, like the newly expanded endometriosis and pelvic pain clinics, which are GP-led models. There's holistic cancer centres. Overseas, there's centres of excellence in ME, where there's research and clinical care combined. And in Australia, we've got some great practitioners doing wonderful things, like integrative GPs, GPs who are specialising in ME and associated conditions, and specialist-led clinics. What I think we need to do is decide how we're going to treat ME and all of the comorbidities in Australia. Can we adopt one of these existing models? Can we take parts from each of them? And then how can we make access to holistic diagnosis and treatment in an ME-accessible way available to everyone? Again, so it's not reliant on people having the money or the location to be able to afford it.
Yeah, I mean, you've just talked about the Holy Grail, haven't you? I think that that's something that we all want. And the challenge is developing the model, we can certainly take bits and pieces from other countries, but making it work for Australia and then seeking the investment, which is not insignificant, as we know. We also know that the investment in ME in Australia compared to the rest of the world is abysmal. So, I mean, that's where organisations like Emerge Australia come in. That's where our advocacy comes in. And I suspect these are the areas that you would like to see us focus on for those that are severely affected.
It is that. I think for me, one clear thing that came out of thinking about this discussion today is the lack of equity. People who have access, who have advantage, they do see improvement. There are answers already out there. Obviously, we need much more research. Obviously, we need much more education. Obviously, we need new treatments, new diagnostic criteria, biomarkers. We need all of that stuff. But I suppose what came to me was that we already know enough to make a difference in people's lives today. How can we move from isolated pockets of excellent care that many people can't afford to consistently good care? How can we reduce the burden on patients navigating disconnected systems?
Yep, absolutely.
How can we make opportunity less dependent on where someone lives, what they can afford, or chancing upon a clinician who knows how to help them? To me, this is not about us not knowing enough. It's about implementing what we already know.
Yeah.
So really my ask to government and policymakers, what can we do now to improve equity? Because that will improve lives.
That's a beautiful line to start rounding off this interview with. I guess finally, is there a message of hope and encouragement that you can give to those, especially those with severe ME, who are feeling isolated and unheard?
Yeah, hope's a really tricky word, I think, for people living with severe ME. And I don't know that I can put myself in a position to say, you know, this is how you should be hopeful. Because we know many people will still be listening in their dark rooms, you know, unable to eat, unable to dress, unable to shower, unable to leave the house, not having sufficient support. And I suppose I think about, what does hope come from? And for me, it comes from more people listening. It comes from more people understanding. It comes from more people believing. And importantly, it comes from more people acting. So I think about, rather than asking people with severe ME to carry hope, I'd like to ask the rest of society to carry responsibility.
Yeah.
For families to believe, for friends to stay connected, for clinicians to keep learning, and decision makers to keep improving. My hope is that this conversation might help more people to understand. It might mean that they can then respond differently. And if enough people respond differently, that's how lives begin to improve.
Wow. What can I say, Tracy? That is like a mantra that I would love to keep using, because you're so articulate and you have looked at this from every angle as someone with severe ME. And I think you've actually provided Emerge Australia with some hope that there are things that can be done. It's a challenge, and it will remain a challenge, but your words ring very true for everyone, certainly with severe ME, and to all of us who out there battling and advocating for exactly the kinds of equitable solutions that you're talking about. So, Tracy Collins, thank you so much for coming on this interview and using your very precious spoons of energy to be so clear in the messages that you have around severe ME. So thank you. And on behalf of all those with severe ME who will listen to this interview, I certainly hope you enjoy it, because the wisdom that you've given us is quite profound, and we'll take a lot of those messages away and see what we can do about them. So thanks, Tracy.
Thanks, Anne, and thank you to everyone at Emerge Australia for everything that you do. Emerge Australia was the first place that actually gave me support and answers to start my journey once I was diagnosed. So thank you.
Our pleasure. So today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and associated overlapping conditions in Australia. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle, and as we prepare to seek renewed investment, we are proud to launch the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education, and health policy change for Australians living with ME/CFS, long COVID, and associated energy-limiting conditions. And that's notwithstanding what Tracy was talking about with regard to learning from other countries around the world that have developed centres of excellence and areas of supporting patients that we in Australia don't yet have. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatised conditions, and provide critical insights to equip decision makers, ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Tracy, once again, thank you so very much for joining me for our podcast today. To everybody listening, tune in for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information, to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or to find out how you can support our vital work, visit our website on www.org.au. Thanks, Tracy, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.